The Kit Bag by Algernon Blackwood. When the words "not guilty" sounded through the crowded courtroom that dark December afternoon, Arthur Wilbraham, the great criminal KC and leader for the triumphant defense, was represented by his junior. But Johnson, his private secretary, carried the verdict across to his chambers like lightning. "It's what we expected, I think," said the barrister without emotion. "And personally, I'm glad the case is over." There was no particular sign of pleasure that his defense of John Turk, the murderer, on a plea of insanity, had been successful, for no doubt he felt, as everybody who had watched the case felt, that no man had ever better deserved the gallows. "I'm glad, too," said Johnson. He had sat in the courts for 10 days, watching the face of the man who had carried out with callous detail one of the most brutal and cold-blooded murders of recent years. The counsel glanced up at his secretary. They were more than employer and employed. For family and other reasons, they were friends. "Ah, I remember, yes," he said with a kind smile. "And you want to get away for Christmas. You're going to skate and ski in the Alps, aren't you? If I was your age, I'd come with you." Johnson laughed shortly. He was a young man of 26 with a delicate face like a girl's. "I can catch the morning boat now," he said. "But that's not the reason I'm glad the trial is over. I'm glad it's over because I've seen the last of that man's dreadful face. It's positively haunted me. That white skin with the black hair brushed low over the forehead is a thing I shall never forget, and the description of the way the dismembered body was crammed and packed with lime into that—" "Don't dwell on it, my dear fellow," interrupted the other, looking at him curiously out of his keen eyes. "And don't think about it. Such pictures have a trick of coming back when one least wants them." He paused a moment. "Now go," he added presently, "and enjoy your holiday. I shall want all your energy for my parliamentary work when you get back. And don't break your neck skiing." Johnson shook hands and took his leave. At the door he turned suddenly. "I knew there was something I wanted to ask you. Would you mind lending me one of your kit bags? It's too late to get one tonight, and I leave in the morning before the shops are open." "Of course. I'll send Henry over with it to your rooms. You shall have it the moment I get home." "I promise to take great care of it," said Johnson gratefully, delighted to think that within 30 hours he would be nearing the brilliant sunshine of the high Alps in winter. The thought of that criminal court was like an evil dream in his mind. He dined at his club and went on to Bloomsbury, where he occupied the top floor in one of those old, gaunt houses in which the rooms are large and lofty. The floor below his own was vacant and unfurnished, and below that were other lodgers whom he did not know. It was cheerless, and he looked forward heartily to a change. The night was even more cheerless. It was miserable, and few people were about. A cold, sleety rain was driving down the streets before the keenest east wind he had ever felt. It howled dismally among the big, gloomy houses of the great squares, and when he reached his rooms, he heard it whistling and shouting over the world of black roofs beyond his windows. In the hall, he met his landlady, shading a candle from the drafts with her thin hand.
"This came by a man from Mr. Wilbraham, sir."
She pointed to what was evidently the kit bag, and Johnson thanked her and took it upstairs with him.
"I shall be going abroad in the morning for 10 days, Mrs. Monks," he said. "I'll leave an address for the letters." "And I hope you'll have a Merry Christmas, sir," she said in a ruckus, wheezy voice that suggested spirits, "and better weather than this."
"I hope so, too," replied her lodger, shuddering a little as the wind went roaring down the street outside. When he got upstairs, he heard the sleet bawling against the window panes. He put his kettle on to make a cup of hot coffee, and then set about putting a few things in order for his absence. "And now I must pack. Such as my packing is," he laughed to himself, and set to work at once. He liked the packing, for it brought the snow mountains so vividly before him, and made him forget the unpleasant scenes of the past 10 days. Besides, it was not elaborate in nature. His friend had lent him the very thing, a stout canvas kit bag,
sack-shaped, with holes round the neck for the brass bar and padlock. It was a bit shapeless, true, and not much to look at, but its capacity was unlimited, and there was no need to pack carefully. He shoved in his waterproof coat, his fur cap and gloves, his skates and climbing boots, his sweaters, snow boots, and ear caps. And then on top of these he piled his woolen shirts and underwear, his thick socks, puttees, and knickerbockers. The dress suits came next, in case the hotel people dressed for dinner, and then, thinking of the best way to pack his white shirts, he paused a moment to reflect. "That's the worst of these kit bags," he mused vaguely, standing in the center of the sitting room where he had come to fetch some string. It was after 10 o'clock. A furious gust of wind rattled the windows as though to hurry him up, and he thought with pity of the poor Londoners whose Christmas would be spent in such a climate, whilst he was skimming over snowy slopes in bright sunshine, and dancing in the evening with rosy-cheeked girls. Ah! That reminded him. He must put in his dancing pumps and evening socks. He crossed over from the sitting room to the cupboard in the landing where he kept his linen. And as he did so, he heard someone coming softly up the stairs. He stood still a moment on the landing to listen. It was Mrs. Monk's step, he thought. She must be coming up with the last post. But then the step ceased suddenly, and he heard no more. They were at least 2 flights down, and he came to the conclusion that they were too heavy to be those of his bibulous landlady. No doubt they belonged to a late lodger who had mistaken his floor. He went into the bedroom and packed his pumps and dress shirts as best he could. The kit bag by this time was 2/3 full, and stood upright on its own base like a sack of flour. For the first time he noticed that it was old and dirty, the canvas faded and worn, and that it had obviously been subjected to rather rough treatment. It was not a very nice bag to have sent him, certainly not a new one, or one that his chief valued. He gave the matter a passing thought, and went on with his packing. Once or twice, however, he caught himself wondering who it could have been wandering down below, for Mrs. Monks had not come up with letters, and the floor was empty and unfurnished. From time to time, moreover, he was almost certain that he had heard a soft tread of someone padding about over the bare boards, cautiously, stealthily, as silently as possible, and further that the sounds had been lately coming distinctly nearer. For the first time in his life, he began to feel a little creepy. Then, as though to emphasize this feeling, an odd thing happened. As he left the bedroom, having just packed his recalcitrant white shirts, he noticed that the top of the kit bag lopped over toward him with an extraordinary resemblance to a human face. The canvas fell into a fold like a nose and forehead, and the brass rings for the padlock just filled the position of the eyes. A shadow, or was it a travel stain? For he could not tell exactly. It looked like hair. It gave him rather a turn, for it was so absurdly, so outrageously like the face of John Turk, the murderer. He laughed, and went into the front room where the light was stronger. "That horrid case has got on my mind," he thought. "I shall be glad of the change of the scene and air." In the sitting room, however, he was not pleased to hear again that stealthy tread upon the stairs, and to realize that it was much closer than before, as well as unmistakably real. And this time he got up and went out to see who it could be creeping about the upper staircase at so late an hour. But the sound ceased. There was no one visible on the stairs. He went to the floor below, not without trepidation, and turned on the electric light to make sure that no one was hiding in the empty rooms of the unoccupied suite. There was not a stick of furniture large enough to hide a dog. Then he called over the banisters to Mrs. Monk's. But there was no answer, and his voice echoed down into the dark vault of the house, and was lost in the roar of the gale that howled outside. Everyone was in bed and asleep, everyone except himself, and the owner of this soft and stealthy tread. "My absurd imagination, I suppose," he thought, It must have been the wind, after all, although it seemed so very real. And close, I thought. He went back to his packing. It was, by this time, getting on towards midnight. He drank his coffee up and lit another pipe, the last before turning in.